Well, good morning and welcome to Bible class this morning. And it's nice and warm in here. Ever since I've stopped messing with the thermostats, it's been more comfortable in here, so I don't touch them anymore. One big announcement this morning is that we're going to be going on break. Our spring break will be beginning for me as soon as I say amen at the end of class today, and we'll be on break from in fact the entire break schedule is on the bulletin board out there, and it's pretty well set. It'll be the schedule that'll show up in the annual meeting. And just by way of a couple of announcements for upcoming events, we're going to be closed for a week, one Sunday anyway, for spring break, and two Wednesdays. So it'll be from basically the very first of April, April 1st through 11th is the closure. And so we'll be back. The next time we'll get together will be Sunday the 12th. And then the other breaks pretty much follow our standard procedure that we've always had. We're going to be having the annual meeting coming up in April, probably April. We will determine that. There's going to be a board meeting of the deacons right after church this morning. So I can't go over today. I'll try and cut things a little bit short for that, because I know the ladies who have to wait on their husbands wait around a little bit too long sometimes. But we will be having a board meeting right after church today, and what we're going to do in that meeting is try to determine the date of the annual meeting. So that'll be coming up in April. Any questions about that? The only reason that we have our annual meeting in April is because when Bob and you guys all started the church, it seemed like every year, we went January to January, and it seemed like every year we had an ice storm. And in the other building, you had to go down steps, and those steps would get all icy. So at a meeting once, we just said, well, what's to stop us from having our fiscal year in any month we want? Nothing. So we said, well, what month do you want? Well, by April it should be all right. So that's how we lit on April. But we will be having that coming up. And if you are a member here, you're really required to be here. And if not, you're certainly welcome to be here for that. Are there any other announcements or anything anybody needs to know about, or you'd like to let the assembly know about this morning before we get started? I did get a little note from Josh Stradlecki and his church up in Minnesota, and they wanted to pass their greetings on to us, and so I reciprocated for us to him and his group, and he said they are just ready to start Romans 8, 14, and 15. So they're just ready for sonship education. Okay, all right. Well, we'll get ourselves underway this morning then. And now please, would you open your Bibles? Once again, we'll start at Romans chapter 13 in our very familiar passage. And we're going to be moving around a little bit today, but I want to try to finish off something that I started on Wednesday night, and I really ended at an awkward place. And so I'm going to try to finish that out this morning. Once again, beginning in verse 11, it says, "And that knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof." Michael, would you lead us in prayer this morning?
Father, we thank you for every opportunity to study your word and to have it increasingly impact our thoughts and decisions. Your grace and patience and long suffering give everyone the opportunity for a life with you. And
This morning we're going to continue our study and really understanding the dispensational timing of this dispensation of grace as we have it in that saying at the beginning of verse 12, the night is far spent, the day is at hand. We've paused for a long time here because of how much this assumes that you know and how critical it is that you do know it sufficiently enough for it to do its effectual job. It has a particular goal, an aim, and an objective for your inner man that once that's done, is, and you can gauge that it's done, you can gauge it by whether or not you really are zealously, joyfully, enthusiastically willing to engage in a battle with the adversary and his policy of evil, because that's exactly where you go next. When you cast off works of darkness, that's a gesture that you are going to perform, and it's going to be seen. It's going to be observable by the adversary, by Satan, by his cohorts. It is a signal to them, so to speak, that you are intelligently understanding what his policy of evil is. You're putting on some armor that is going to shed light upon it. You're going to cast these works off, intelligently knowing what you're doing when you do that. And by doing that, you're basically calling for the adversary to take you on. And that sounds, if it wasn't for all the work that we've done, that sounds two things. It sounds either scary or it sounds like a bunch of human bravado. But it is neither of those things, because Romans chapter 8, verses 28 through 39, did the work to take both of those issues out of the picture. If you've gone through that properly, you have no human bravado in thinking that you're going to take on Satan and his cohorts, the policy of evil, and one day be able to do battle like it's described in the book of Ephesians, where we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and mights and thrones and dominions and darkness in the heavenly spiritual, in the heavenly realm, and all of that kind of thing. All that human bravado, it was ripped out of us and thrown away with those five heartfelt probing questions. The other issue of the scariness of it, that's no longer an issue either, because of the effectual working of all of the godly edification that we've had so far. This is something a son and a daughter really wants to do. And you're not going to be thrown into a battle situation where you have no idea what you're doing, you're overwhelmed or any of those things. You start out very mild. I use the expression oftentimes, they're almost like skirmish battles, little skirmishes that we're going to have. But we begin to really come onto the radar of the adversary by doing this. By the way, it was at this very point, I think it's more of a pinpointed area that you can see where a group of saints like the Corinthians had problems. And I'm understanding better and better why they had the problems they had. And we have that book sitting there right after the book of Romans, so that it's going to take up the slack on some of the problems we're liable to have. But what I'm after here is that we begin to, now in this phrase, and I'm not going to go through all the review and everything, but I've tried to put some things on the board. I've made this a little bit smaller here so that we can see this crisis point. And so I'm kind of putting everything up here, and if these arrows up here get a little bit too much, I can just take them off. But those represent, of course, Israel's fall into the world of the ungodly and their cooperation with the world of the ungodly. But what we're trying to gain an appreciation for is what this night is, and we've talked a lot about it, and I said on Wednesday night, we're going to turn a corner here, not talking about this attitude any longer of the hatred and the godly abhorrence for it, but we're going to have to pointedly focus our attention for the next couple of Bible classes at least upon the mover, the shaker, the one who really is behind all of this, and to have a better understanding of who he is and what he's about than just simply the kind of what I call the wild ideas that many Christians have of Satan and his works and his plan and his policy of evil and all of these kinds of things. There's a wild variety of of understanding of who he was or who he is or if he really exists and all of this kind of business. And we're not going to do a whole detailed study into Satan and everything, but we do need to at some point in this, we're going to have to talk about, especially if we're going to deal with the world of the ungodly developing, and that it has this evil and this iniquity at its core that functions up here, like I've used this little fire as the works of darkness that Paul describes there, these works of darkness that fuel and propagate and promote and keep that whole thing going, so that when this dispensation ends and God resumes his program with Israel, these things are going to be in their white hot condition, just as they were in when God declared the world, both Israel and the world at large, apostate Israel and the world at large, to be those vessels of wrath fitted to destruction. And God's wrath is going to therefore be righteous and just and holy when he does pour his wrath out and judge these things and works and workers of darkness on this earth. We fortunately live in a time when God's wrath is being held back, and a time in which he is being patient and long-suffering, and that goodness has led many millions and millions to repentance and to saving knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, somewhere in talking about all this, we've got to talk about the adversary himself. And I use the term for Satan, the adversary, because that's one of the expressions God himself uses. It's what the name Satan, the title, actually Satan is a title, what it means. Satan, the word Satan means adversary. And that's the reason why I use it so much. And so that's kind of my thing here, and just want to make sure that we're all on the same page. Well, like I said, we're going to now turn our attention more for a few classes upon this adversary component, and we need to get a little bit past just the general, overall, basic understanding of what we've been doing, which is really basic, and now look at something a little bit more particular and a little more specific than just the general in the involvement and the activities of Satan that brought this night to its far-spent status, and where he's only going to be able, he only has to take it one more step, so to speak, out here to bring it to its full status. Right in here is where he's going to do that. And one of the things that that's going to accomplish is some goals that he's got for these works of darkness that's going to play into his hand out there when he accomplishes something or tries to accomplish something that God is going to actually give him the right to try to do. And this all goes back to the very beginning, and we can go all the way back to the start when God created everything to begin with and created the angelic world, and in that angelic world he created these cherubim, and of one of these cherubim he put in a very high place called this one particular cherub called Lucifer. And we went back, what I want to do is I want to try to look at his involvement and his activities in producing the world of the ungodly and bringing the vessels of wrath to the point where they were fitted to destruction. And so we've been looking at his activities. And I'm going to do something here that's probably going to aggravate some people, but I don't mean to aggravate you. Please bear with me. You should be used to this by now. What I did on Wednesday night, I need to have what I did on Wednesday night all together. That all needs, and what I'm going to do today, it needs to all be together. In other words, I can't look at Wednesday night and what we did on Wednesday night as just separate from what I'm going to do today. Because I was running through some verses, and I was trying to get to the real payoff verse, and I talked myself out of time, which I commonly do. I just go and go and go. And so this morning, I want to not review everything that we did on Wednesday night, but it's really important that we have all these verses together. And because if you don't, you're not going to understand exactly why this last verse or last section that we're going to look at, why we're doing that. So what I did, and I'm just going to go through this again real quickly to try to bring us up where we need to be and to finish this off. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to, in these couple of classes, I'm trying to take us back to understanding, and again, this is a massive, massive subject that we could spend long amounts of time on, and I just can't do that. If you want, I don't know if we have any here anymore, but I'd encourage you to get Keith Blade's book, Satan and His Plan of Evil, which you can get a lot more detail than what we're going to be going over today. But there's a matter that even in that book, Keith brushes against it, but he doesn't go into it as much as we need to understand what's going on. And that's what I want to try to touch on today, is that you get a sense of why God and Satan are at such odds with each other, and how everything represented on this chart is the collective aftermath of something that began all the way back with a contention between Satan, but even before he was God's Satan, the adversary, he was Lucifer, and as he existed in the throne of God and around the throne of God, he immediately set on a path of contending with God. I know we used to call it the angelic conflict, and that's not wrong. It is a conflict. But the words that God uses is it's a contention. There is a vying, a contending, as I've often said, for who is going to really be the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. But there's a particular aspect to all of that I want to focus upon that you may not think, even when you hear it today, that it's such a big thing or a earth-shaking new thing. But I'm going to tell you right now, when we get to it and I start to point this out, I'm going to tell you right now, it's something that we don't understand, and I'm not saying this critically, we're not supposed to understand it to the point that I'm talking about right now. We don't understand it to the level we need to. And one of the things that if you go to the book of Ephesians and you start looking at these more mature books that occur in our education as we get into level 2 of our sonship education, it starts talking a lot about this particular subject. And it's a word that Christians use all the time. But it's also a word that very few of them really understand the significance of. And I'll leave you on that cliffhanger there for just a moment until we get to it. But to get to it, and to further understand what this contention is about, and it's going to play into an understanding of what these works of darkness are for, and how they're going to play into the hand of the adversary, we need to understand something about that original contention that took place between him and God himself. That's okay, Cecil. We won't throw you out. Oh, it's telling you to get up and go to church? That's the best excuse that I've ever heard. All right, this is what we did on Wednesday. We went to a couple of passages, the two most familiar passages. And I think I'm going to, I don't know if I'm going to skip one or not, but I'm going to do this in a little bit reversed order. Come to Ezekiel 28. Come back to Ezekiel 28. Ezekiel 28. Yeah, it's a big book. You should be able to find it. In this particular passage, this is one of the two most famous passages in the Bible about Satan and his activities as far as his beginning of his activities, where Ezekiel is being utilized. Ezekiel is a fifth course of punishment prophet that's being utilized to use the area in this world at the time that Ezekiel was writing in which Satan kind of headquartered himself and began utilizing some individuals to his own ends and purposes. And one of these individuals was this king of Tyre. And he becomes almost a personified way of viewing Satan and talking about Satan because of his activities being so in cooperation with the satanic policy of evil. And I'm not going to go into all of that background, but just to once again read this. And when we did this on Wednesday, I want you to cue into some things. We've read this passage many times, but again, just be aware of the many things that are said here that are almost of a spiritual nature, that we're not reading this just to see he did this and this and this and this, but why he was involved in these kinds of things. So come over to Ezekiel 28 and look at verse 11. We'll just read from paragraph mark to paragraph mark. Verse 11, it says, Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus, and say unto him, Thus saith the Lord God. Now this is the king of Tyrus, who is now this personification of Satan. And so what he's saying about Satan himself and his career as he got his career underway and got it launched. And if my understanding's correct, this happened very quickly. If my understanding's correct, God created the angels on probably day one, and by day two, this happened. You say, well, how could that happen so fast? I don't know. Have you ever walked into a room of people and you look at somebody and you automatically take up an instant dislike for that person for no particular reason? But Satan had a very particular reason. And the reason I say that is because if you go back and you read the 6 days of creation the 6 days in which God created, the seventh day he rested, 5 out of those 6 days, God says, it is good. There's only one day where God never says anything was good. And it's day two. Something happened on day two where God did not proclaim it good. He kind of made up for it, though, because on day six, he proclaimed it good twice. When he finished creating everything and when he finally capped it off with the ultimate of his creation, mankind, when he created Adam. Anyway, so he says, this is beginning to express Satan's activity. He says, Thus saith the Lord God, Thou sealest up the sum, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Far different from the horrific Hollywood idea of Satan, perfect in beauty. Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. And as I said on Wednesday, I'm not saying he wasn't in the Eden on earth as the serpent, but I think this is referring to the Eden that exists in the third heaven where God's abode is. Every precious stone was thy covering, the sardis, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, sapphire, the emerald, the carbuncle, the gold, the workmanship, the gold. Stop right there. All of these rocks, these precious stones, are still very much a part of us today. Again, don't think about the actual stones or rocks, but think about the fact that why do people still put those rocks on today? Why do women and men both bedeck themselves with these same rocks? There's some kind of a spiritual connection to them, and there is. And there's a reason why they show up in the breastplate of the high priest in Israel's program. Why they show up in the foundation of the New Jerusalem. And why I'm going to wind up getting off into another subject here, but one of the reasons why those are some particular things that God is going to do with light. And when the light strikes those things, and they have something to do with the heavenly realm as well, and how it's going to be lit one day. Satan knows what God's doing with these things. He knows what God's design is for them. He knows far more than people think. He goes on to say, the workmanship of thy tabrets and thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day that thou was created. Those are all musical things. Satan was the original choir director of the praise and worship services. And again, there's very few things in this life that affect you on a spiritual level any more powerfully than music does. I know, being a musician, how it affects me. Can't hardly spend outside of studying which I can't have any interruption at all. Outside of studying, I got to have music everywhere I go. Whoever invented that little, I've got like a little Sony Walkman thing, not the old tape, but it's got the MP3 player. Whoever invented that was a genius. I'd just like to shake his hand because I can put, I got walking music, man. Cindy gets laughing at my walking music that I have. I have all kinds. I've got marches on there. Some of the best walking music, Colonel Bogey. How many people in this room right now know what Colonel Bogey is? Not one of you. Ah, now you all know. Yeah, Bridge Over the River Kwai. Well, that's Colonel, the name of that song is Colonel Bogey. Great walking music, terrific walking music. Now, I've been talking about stuff that has no bearing on anything, but let's get back to where we were. My point in all of this is music has a very powerful way of touching you on a very spiritual level. Well, look who was in charge of it. Look who knows the manipulation of music more than any other being God ever created. And by the way, God is a God of music. Just think about it. Would you rather listen to Blessed Assurance or, Higher Ground or Be Thou My Vision is just, or The Love of God, some of these hymns. Think about the hymns that we have, the songs that we sing, we don't much hear, but the songs that are sung versus, who the heck? I mean, that just is like, what God in his right mind would care about? That just does nothing. Seriously. Like I said, I can't wait. If I get to ask any requests of anybody else, I mean, any other believers, I'm going to pull David aside. I want to hear David sing those psalms. That guy, he understood, by the way, he could take Nebuchadnezzar, he could take King Saul, and King Saul could be having total mental breakdown, and David could bring peace to his heart through that door of the Spirit. And that's something that I'm going to come back to, but that's one of the things that we read on Wednesday night, this passage, to think more in terms of what spiritually was being picked up upon that could be part of Satan's manipulation of the creation itself and those that are in it. And so he talks about the workmanship of his musical ability. Verse 14, Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth. He covered the entire throne of God. I have set thee so. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. Thou wast perfect in the way in thy ways from the day thou wast created until iniquity. There's that word we've worked upon before, the wicked in their iniquity, till iniquity was found in thee. By the multitude of thy merchandise, they have filled the midst of thee with violence. He started trafficking in things. And by the way, Satan, when he fell, when he sinned, if my understanding's correct, I didn't say this on Wednesday night either, but if my understanding's correct, when Satan fell, you know, a lot of people say, well, why aren't angels still falling today? Why does it seem like that the ones who sided with Satan, and there was a huge amount of angelic beings that sided with him. We call them fallen angels, devils. Some people use the word demons, although the Bible never uses the word demons. The King James never does. But if my understanding is correct, the majority of the ones that he got to side with him were of the highest ranking angels. In fact, there's a fascinating passage when Gabriel's talking. He says that, and Gabriel being an archangel, he says, Michael and I are the only ones left. Meaning out of all of those higher angels, they were the only ones left. So when Satan, that's one of the reasons why the heavenly places are populated with these principalities and powers and mights and dominions and thrones of fallen angels under the auspices of Satan himself. And if my understanding is correct, the reason why that got to a point and stopped was because of God's response to it. Do you know what God's response to Satan's fall and the angelic worlds starting to side with him, what God immediately did? Does anybody know? That's right. He created the lake of fire. And we could go and find in the book of the Revelation, we could find passages in the gospel accounts that talk about the lake of fire being specifically created for Satan and his angels, for them. Now, all lost souls are going to find themselves there eventually, but the fact of the matter is, when he did that, I think that put an immediate break on anybody else siding. You know, when the angelic world saw that the lake of fire was created, like, you were thinking about going over to that side, and then you said, I don't think so. I think I'll stay over here. So, probably the creation of the lake of fire was what kind of set the sides of the angelic world in cement, in concrete, that's where they're set now for good. But in these verses, you get and we don't have time to go into all of these. I'm going to set the stage up in this session, then we'll hit the big thing in the next one. But the details here are just fascinating. He goes on to talk about the violence that was found in him. Thou hast sinned in the middle of verse 16. Therefore I will cast thee as profane out of the mountain of God, and I will destroy thee, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Thine heart was lifted up because of thy beauty. Thou hast corrupted thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness. I will cast thee to the ground, lay thee before kings that they may behold thee. Thou hast defiled thy sanctuaries in the multitude of thine iniquities. He had some sanctuaries, some places, some strongholds. By the iniquity of thy traffic, therefore I will bring forth a fire from the midst of thee. It shall devour thee. I will bring thee to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all men that behold thee. And they that know thee among the people shall be astonished at thee. Thou shalt be a terror, and never shalt thou be any more. I just love how verse 19 ends. Well, we talked a little bit more about this on Wednesday night. I don't have time to go into that. But again, if you have some time to read through this even more, and think more about the terms of what Satan has at his disposal, that's at his availability, where he has the means to do things that affect you or affect the creation on a spiritual level. Because that's a gate in which he can be able to, therefore, influence. And what's the word I always... I always... forget this word. It's not control. It's he influences and he conditions. I don't know why that word always gets out of my mind. He conditions. He's continually conditioning you for further acceptance, to dim your light, to put your light out, and to shine his own light. He has another. He was the original light bearer, by the way. That's one of the reasons why people scratch their head and wonder, well, in the beginning, God says he created light. God said, let there be light. Boom, there was light. Well, who was bearing the light? Him. That's what the word Lucifer means, light bearer. Then on day two, boom, the light goes out. So on day four of creation, what does God have to create? Sun, moon, stars, and create other light sources. By the way, you can have light without the sun, right? We do in here. No sun. Those are all little lights. But anyway, all right? Let's go back to the other passage that's so familiar about Satan, and that is in Isaiah 14. And I'm going to have to zip through this too. I'm basically, the folks that were here on Wednesday are getting a second class on this. But... like I said, I really need this all to be done together. Isaiah chapter 14. A very famous passage of the I wills, of what went on in Satan's mind when he sinned, when that all was described there in Isaiah or in Ezekiel 28. Pick it up at verse 12. Once again, he says, "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, the light-bearer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart," and these are five I wills. And by the way, he says it in his heart. God is writing something that Satan doesn't, he's not talking, but he evidently expresses all five of these at certain points. But he says, "Thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High." And verse 15, "Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell to the sides of the pit. But I will be like the Most High." And that's the shortened version of Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And one of the things we noted again on Wednesday night was that those five I wills actually have, in the middle of them, you have the "I will ascend to heaven, exalt my throne above the stars, sit upon the mount of the congregations, ascend above the heights of the clouds, I'll be like the Most High." But these middle three I wills, and I don't have time to do all this, but my understanding is those three I wills, all, the first and second one tell you exactly what they're after. They're after a throne. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. You have a throne in the third I will. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation. You don't have it stated, but you have an implied throne in the fourth I will with the word ascend. That's what you do. That's what a king does. A king ascends to his throne, whether he just goes up one step or whether he goes up. It's another reason why Cindy was talking to me about this. Why the pagan religions of the world that were spawned and sponsored by the adversary all seem to have these high places. You notice that? I mean, you go and you see the ziggurats and the pyramids, and they have high places. That's because it's indicative of ascending to heights of thrones, and that all has to do with power and governing and all of those kinds of things. But what I want to get to this morning is something at the very core of this, which is where this contention really lies. Well, my understanding is you've got three thrones here. And that first one, "I will exalt my throne above the stars of God." As I talked about on Wednesday night, this is an exalted throne where the Bible talks about the stars of God oftentimes as angels themselves. And the angels inhabit the celestial world oftentimes. And we talk about that. But what I'm after is that both the angelic realm and the realm in which they inhabit is what this throne is really about. It's one that puts Satan in an exalted position over the angelic realm and the realm of all creation. He seeks dominion by dominating that angelic realm over the entire creation, as it were, his own possession. And he aspires to rule over the creatures of God and to exude his own will and execute his will among them. And he by doing that, is going to go after the throne of creation itself. And by sitting on that throne, there's something, it's not just this. It is power that he wants. Satan is not all that interested in money. He was in charge of all these fabulously wealthy rocks, but he's after these thrones because with them he can actually get something that only God gets. And the first of those is to get that throne of creation. And then he comes along and he says, "I will sit." This is another throne he's sitting upon the mount of the congregation. This is a throne, very interesting, when you go through the Bible, as I mentioned on Wednesday again, Since it's called being called the mount of the congregation, it's apparent that there's a specific mount in view in God's abode, in that third heaven, that heavenly realm where God lives at right now, and that's only going to be temporary. He's going to move his residence from the third heaven to the earth once he puts his kingdom upon this earth, and he's going to live here in the midst of his creation. But there's a specific mountain. That's another thing that I found out as I studied the Bible. God likes mountains. He likes hills. He likes mountains. And he's big on clouds. There's something. This is a doctrine, and this is a thing about the Bible that I've got to tell you, I know a thimbleful about, but I think it's one of the most fascinating studies, and I'm working on it. And it's the issue of clouds. Clouds have some big thing to do. Every time God shows up, he shows up in a cloud. And there's some kind of power involved in that cloud. And it's an amazing thing, but I don't have my finger on it just yet, but it's another one of those back burner things. But this particular mount of the congregation, if you go over and you study some things in the book of Job, you find that there was a day, well, you don't need to read it, but I'll read it, but in Job it says, in Job 1, it says, there was a day when the sons of God, they're talking about the angels, came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, whence comest thou? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. That's his gesture of possession of the earth. And he says again, in chapter 2, it comes up again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. See, Satan had to present himself. And the Lord said unto Satan, from whence comest thou? Satan answered, and going to and fro in the earth, and walking up and down in it. What I'm after there is that, my understanding of that is that there was a convocation of angelic beings that had to take place on a regular basis, and they had to give an account to them of themselves to God himself. And they had to present themselves. They're accountable to him for some things that they were supposed to be doing. And one of the things that Satan wants is that throne where all these beings now are going to have to be accountable to him, and therefore will rule over the creatures of God's creation as his own servants. And I am saying that for a reason. So if you don't know why, just stick it in the back of your head for a moment. That last throne, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. Again, an ascension like this, in this context, I believe is really, and again, you've got clouds here, but you've got something that is being ascended to, and my understanding is there's a throne involved with this as well. And this is where it really gets down. This is it's kind of like these are all big, but this is the one that I think he so covets. And this is the word, and I'm going to spill the beans here, that I was talking about at the beginning of class. I thought long and hard about this. Cindy was asking me when I was driving in today, she goes, you look like you're really deep in thought. And I've been struggling over the last several days as to how to keep this back until the very end and spring it on you. And I just can't do it. I've got to tell you what it is ahead of time because we're dealing with this throne. And then we're going to talk about it some more. But what this is talking about is a throne that he ascends to above the heights of the clouds. And if my understanding's correct, this is a throne in which, and here's the word that I've been holding back. You all know it. You're going to hear it and say, oh, well, I know that word. And it's the word glory. But there is a glory that belongs to God, and the worship that he is due from his creation, and obviously is the issue that Satan is after with all the gust and zeal and gusto and enthusiasm he can get with this particular throne by occupying it. and taking up a position, as it says, above the heights of the clouds. You even hear astronauts and even pilots talk about that when they fly and they get above the clouds, or when they break, the astronauts break out of our atmosphere and they see the stars without any pollution of any kind, even light pollution. The word they'll often use, even if they're unbelievers, they'll talk about it was just glorious, the glory of it. And they're looking at it in its worst condition. It's a mess, and it looks glorious. Well, this is high above all of that. And this is a throne and an occupation of a place where the throne of God's own glory was sitting, and Satan was just merely one who was, as it said before, was a covering for that. He didn't really have any right to that throne whatsoever, and certainly had no right to what came to the one who sat on that throne. And as God's sworn enemy and adversary, he makes this the object of his desire, because he desires above all things worship and praise and the expressions of adoration. And he clothes himself with positions of splendor and magnificence and grandeur to receive to himself praise of his own glorification. And so he will therefore occupy what is tantamount to a throne of worship. That's what he wants. He doesn't want to just be followed. He wants to be worshiped. And as I said before, he will ruin you to get that. He cares nothing for you. He wants servants, but he doesn't want... By the way, there is a single four-letter word that describes all of that. And it's probably the most familiar word in the Bible, but I'll leave that for a moment. But that's what he wants, and he'll do it at any cost, and he'll do it at your ruin, because he knows that you're in a sinful condition, and so he's going to fuel that sinful condition to achieve his own aims with some particular works of darkness that is going to leave in its wake millions and millions of ruined lives, of death and destruction, and of human beings who are going to wind up in that lake of fire that was designed for him. He still thinks he can escape that. And he doesn't care how many millions he destroys in the process. He knows what he can do to a human being to achieve that end, their worship. And oh, the torture that a human heart has to go through in order to worship Satan. Well, okay, enough said. We could say an awful lot more on that. The other passage we covered on Wednesday night is found over in... There's something I wanted you to see here. I'm going to connect all this together in the next session. But like I said, these thrones and these I wills that end up with "I will be like the Most High," this is his plan. This is the overall objective of the satanic plan of evil. Everything he does, whether it's in Israel's program or with us in this dispensation of grace, has these objectives in mind. His policies change. His policies, for instance, there's some policies he had with Israel that wouldn't even work with you today. But he has some policies of evil that definitely do work with you today. And we'll become aware of those as we go on. But one of the things I wanted you to see, let's go back to that chart that we've had up here of the timeline, where whereas Satan, with those three thrones in view, as he had developed the world of the ungodly and God judged it and destroyed it, and then as he starts to redevelop it and get it all going again, he goes after... He doesn't know anything about this dispensation, so he goes right after Abraham. And because he knows Abraham performs that same gesture of possession that Satan did in Job. In Job, Satan, God says, "Where you been?" "I've been in the earth, walking up and down, to and fro in it." One of the very first things God does when he calls Abraham, he sends him into the promised land, and he says, I want you to walk the entire perimeter of that. I want you to walk the fence line of the entire piece of property. That was a gesture of possession. I own this. This is mine. And that was a red flag in the face of Satan that God is starting to take this earth back. And as Israel developed, Satan and his policy of evil against them by the world at large, the world of the Gentiles, the world of the pagan religions and the heathen Gentile world, they just attracted Israel to it, and Israel became more and more to the point where when Jesus was born and on this earth, the world and Israel were just hand in hand. They had married one another. They had become mated together. And in fulfillment, like I've said many times, of Psalm 2, where both the world at large and apostate Israel have come together against his Christ, against his Messiah, against the Lord Jesus Christ. And both of them were seen there the day that Jesus was crucified. You had Rome representing the entire pagan world at large. You had the Pharisees, the Sadducees representing all of apostate Israel. All the vessels that fitted to destruction were there and on full display when they took the Lord Jesus Christ and beat him beyond recognition and nailed him to a cross and crucified him. But what I'm after is that something that God said a long time before that event ever took place was designed, and he said it repeatedly, we'll look at one of those passages, to get it into the heads of the members of Israel of how they were going to be affected by the world of the ungodly. That Satan had begun with his plan of evil so long ago. Come back to Exodus chapter 14. I'm sorry, Exodus chapter, not 14, 34. Exodus 34. Brought this out on Wednesday night as well. I'm going to bring something out a little bit more than I did on Wednesday night. But this is right after, this sounds stupid, but it's right after chapter 33. And chapter 33 is where the Israelites go up to the land, and God says, now go in there and take it. Satan knew what the land was all about. That's why Satan specifically took the land of Israel, or the land of Canaan, and fortified that with every unclean spirit and every kind of defilement that he could with all these Canaanites. The Canaanites are the world of the ungodly. The Canaanites are Gentiles, and with all of their pagan religions that all went back to the Tower of Babel and went back to Baal and went back to Nimrod, all of those things now were just polluted the land. It was so vile and so vicious and so disgusting, it not only affected every human being, men, women, and children, it affected all of the animals. So what in the world were they doing with these animals? Your imagination probably isn't filthy enough to even come to the point of grasping what they were doing. And Israel goes up there and God says, get them! And they said, wait a minute! There are giants in there. We're not going. Well, because of that, the Lord got fairly angry with the people of Israel. The law takes place, and Moses comes down off of the mountain. You remember from the movie, Charlton Heston comes down there with the big tablets. And they've made this molten image of a calf, and he smashes the tablets, uses them as a hand grenade. And the calf, the molten calf, as I've talked to you many classes ago, it goes all the way back to, it's a calf, so it has a father and a mother that go right back to Nimrod in the Tower of Babel. And God is so angry with them because they've been involved in not only that, idol worship, but they also got involved in all of the pagan orgies that was going on around it. The Bible doesn't use the word orgy. You know what word it uses? Play. They rose up to play. Let's play. And they were committing all, and God got so angry with them, he basically gets Moses and he says, look, I'm going to kill them all and I'm going to start again with you. And Moses pleads their case and says, please don't do that. And you have all of that take place. You have the marvelous reserve clause that God gives in chapter 33 that he will be gracious upon who will be gracious. And that actually provides the basis for which he could legally change the dispensation, change the programs. Then we get chapter 34. And in chapter 34, we come down here and pick it up where God is going to tell them something about what they're going to be experiencing when they go into the land. And how dangerous it is. And we get the idea that was then, this is now. But folks, we are in as dangerous a position as they were. Not with Canaanites, but with other forces in this world. I will tell you right now, whether you want to believe this or not, pretty much everything you are, good or bad, is based on a spiritual matter of some kind. Or it's there because of your spirit. And my view of my spirit was always very narrow. I'm starting to get a much more wider perspective of just how big of an issue the human spirit really is. And I want you to see some of these things come up here. Look at what he says. Begin in verse 10. It says, and he said, behold, I make a covenant before all thy people. I will do marvels such as have not been done in all the earth nor in any nation. And all the people among which thou art shall see the work of the Lord. By the way, that's capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. That's Jehovah. For it is a terrible thing that I will do with thee. Verse 10 is a covenant we've all become familiar with that God makes with Israel. He does not make that covenant with us. He makes a covenant with Israel to do marvels and works like that. That's something he doesn't make with us. Today we know that that's not the way God operates. We walk by faith, not by sight. And most people who talk about miracles have no idea why God even performed a miracle. He didn't perform a miracle just to say, see those guns? He didn't do that. He didn't perform a miracle. By the way, almost every miracle that God ever performed had a very negative response. Most every time he performed a miracle, people hated him for it. He performed those miracles, as he says here, to put on display his glory and his power to the Gentiles, to the rest of the nations of the world. And he goes in verse 11, he says, observe thou that which I command thee this day. Behold, I drive out before thee. These are all the ones that were in there in Canaan. The Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite. Those are those disgusting cohorts of Satan himself. Take heed to thyself, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land. Whither thou goest, lest it be for a snare in the midst of thee. But ye shall destroy their altars, break their images, and cut down their groves. For thou, now watch how this ties into what we were talking about, these thrones. Look at verse 14. For thou shalt worship no other god, small case g god, for the Lord, Jehovah, capital O, capital O, capital R, capital D, whose name is Jealous. Did you know God's name was Jealous? One of the names of God is Jealous, is a jealous God. And by the way, the jealousy of God here is perfect, godly jealousy, which is not envious of what another possesses. That's our jealousy. That's human jealousy. But rather, this jealousy is a jealousy of protectiveness. He's protecting. What is he protecting? He's protecting his holiness. He's protecting his character and his essence, which solely belongs to him as the Creator. In being jealous of that which belongs to him exclusively, God protectively responds to any violations of his will, along with any offenses to any of the aspects of his character and essence. That's why he says, my name is Jealousy. My name is jealous. Lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go a whoring after other gods, and do sacrifice unto their gods, and one call thee, and thou eat of his sacrifice, and thou take of their daughters unto thy sons, and their daughters unto go a whoring after their gods, and make sons go a whoring after their gods, thou shalt make thee no molten gods. And as I said on Wednesday, and we'll end here, and that'll set us up nicely for next session. What he ends up telling them here, and this isn't the only place. This mirrors several passages where he does this very thing. But this is so well put right here for our purposes. As I said on Wednesday, what he is so driving at here with the Israelites is that if they don't take heed to what he says, and they go after these other gods, and they start worshiping other gods, what is it, and I said this on Wednesday, and before you answer, before the Wednesday nighters answer, what is it that the Lord, that God knows that if they do this, he will begin to stop being to Israel? If they do this, it's the beginning of him stopping to be something to Israel. And that's where you get down to the lowest common denominator of it all. Do you know what it is? It's in the text. It's a four-letter word, and it's all in caps. Lord. That's one of the reasons why I said the King James translators took the name Jehovah. Up there in the Hebrew, it goes from right to left. YHWH. We would pronounce it Jehovah. And only on rare occasions do they translate it Jehovah. The vast majority of the time, they translate it capital L, capital O, capital R, Lord. Why? That's not what Jehovah means. Actually, God told Moses the translation of the word Jehovah back in Genesis 3. When he said, look, I'm going to go and represent you before the nations. They're going to want to know who you are. What's your name? And he took his name Jehovah, and he said, the definition of my name is, I am that I am. And then he gave him the shortened version of it. I am blank. And that shortened version, he would fill that blank in for them with all those seven Jehovah compound names. I will be your conquering hero. I will be your redeemer. I will be your conquering hero, Jehovah Nissi. Your Redeemer, Jehovah Rofeka, Jehovah Nissi, Jehovah Zidkenu, I'll be your righteousness. All those Jehovah compound names. But the issue is that in the English word Lord, it comes from the bread keeper, and it's the bread Lord, a master, an employer. The important part of this is, what I like about it is it's the head of a household, in his relation to the servants and the dependents who eat his bread. God is the one who provides. And there's something that the Lord of the house gets because he provides, because he's the bread keeper, and because he provides so well for his servants and those who depend upon him, and he feeds them properly and he cares for them properly. And what does he get in return? Glory. He gets the worship. He gets the glory. He gets the respect. He gets the credit for what he provided. This all ties together. And whether you think it does or not in your mind, or whether you think it's interesting or not in your mind, believe me when I tell you, this is the thing that is the nut and nub of the entire controversy between the adversary and God. And you're caught up in it. Because you're going to give glory and you're going to worship something and someone. It's just a matter of who and what and how. Well, I've taken you over time, but this is the reason why when Satan goes about to establish his own God on this earth, he calls him Baal. The word Baal means Lord. That's what the word Baal means. And we went through and showed you where that first occurred in the Bible. Well, we're not going to do that. I've gone through these charts before. But that's what's up for grabs. And that sets us up now for what we're going to look at when we come back after our break. And we're going to take a break right here because I know you're exhausted. So we'll take a break and we'll come back. And please, by the way, if you go back there to the coffee thing, please try not to drip and slop and all that kind of thing. We're trying to keep the place as nice as possible and just try and be civilized with your coffee. Don't throw it on each other or something.